I'm very happy now to welcome to the program John Block. He's a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
One of the things that we've been following on this program is environmental regulation in the state of New Mexico, and we've talked about the rules affecting the many dairies of the state of New Mexico. Tell us about the fairly, you know, the recent history of dairy regulation. There were some regulations passed. Was it last year?
Yes, it was. I think it might be good to just very briefly mention some of the changes that have taken place leading up to those regulations. People don't realize that in New Mexico there were less than 50,000 dairy cows in 1975. By the end of 2006, there were something on the order of 350,000 dairy cows. Milk production moved from a low per month of around 180 million pounds per month to almost 660 million pounds per month at the end of 2006. We're talking about an enormous industry, an industry where, although it's unfair to characterize all of the dairies in this way, that now the largest percentage of them are dairies with 2,000 or more animals, and they are confined animal feeding operations. The average return, not net but gross, on one of these operations is probably something on the order of $8 million. The industry itself is producing about $1.5 billion a year gross revenue direct production from dairy. And because of this shift, there's been naturally an ensuing issue with where the waste, the liquid and solid waste, goes in the environment. And this led, in beginning in about 2007, to an understanding on the part of the Environment Department here that something needed to be done.
Now, if I remember correctly, because we have talked with various people about this, other states have put into place dairy regulations, and those types of dairies that really wanted to make the maximum amount of money with the least concern for the environment found New Mexico a kind of friendly place to go. Is that right?
Well, I think it's certainly the case for some of them. During the dairy hearings, we did hear again and again from dairy operators who came and testified there in the public comment portion that they'd been in Washington or in Idaho, and the climate got bad, and so they moved to Nebraska or
the
Texas.
The regulatory climate.
And that's exactly what they meant, was the regulatory climate. They came here because we had a low level of regulation. And what characterized the earlier regulations was a 180-degree difference in the ones that have just been passed and now very recently passed as revisions. That is, the original model was that if you were a dairy operator, you came to the Environment Department with a proposal for dealing with your issues. It wasn't that there were regulations that specified how things would be done and what kinds of protections would be in place. Rather, the onus was on the operator to provide that plan to the department, and it wasn't working. And by 2007, there were something on the order of 72% of the dairies had issues with leaks of some kind involving nitrate pollution of the water supply, and the department was getting very concerned. The industry itself was concerned because with the then lack of specifics, there wasn't the thing that business people like, and that's regulatory certainty.
Right.
So between 2007 and 2009, they did a dance back and forth, and ultimately the industry itself pushed to have a requirement that regulations be put in place. And it's one of those things of ending up getting what you ask for and being surprised by it. The regulations that were adopted were probably a lot more stringent than the industry had expected. Certainly not sufficiently stringent to put anyone out of business, but
which nobody wants to do.
Right, of course not. But compared with what they had before, which was, in a sense, self-regulation of their own making, this was a big difference. And at the beginning of the current administration, as the regulations were supposed to be put into effect by publication, one of the lawyers who was in fact representing the dairy industry came forward and had been trying to stop the publication in order to stop the regulations from going into effect. That foray was picked up by the current administration, who then pressed the State Records Department not to publish the rules.
They did the same thing for the carbon regulations.
They did it for something like 37 regulations.
And they just thought, here are rules that have been passed. Hey, if we don't print them on paper, maybe they'll go away?
Well, the reality is, if they're not printed, if they're not published, then they don't go into effect. It is part of a process, and the very last part of the process is the agency that's promulgating the rules publishes something called a statement of reasons. The rules are sent down. The proponent of the rules, in this case the Environment Department and some of the other regulations, then delivers them over to State Records. They go through a process, and then they are published. And once they're published, they're in effect. So they tried to stop it. And as you know, I mean, as probably many of your listeners know, the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, a unique gift to this community.
Yes, indeed.
Got involved, and we went after them on the greenhouse gas regulations and on these regulations. Bruce Frederick on greenhouse gases, me on this one. Bruce did a fine job in the argument, and he won. And then the rules were published. Well, while we were going through that appeal process, you know, asking for the court to take an extraordinary action, which it did take, in the meantime, the dairy industry did what any litigator would do. They lodged an appeal, and that appeal was pending. So although our dairy regulations got published, there was an appeal lodged in the Court of Appeals. They then moved for a stay. In the meantime, of course, the governor was reappointing members to the Water Quality Control Commission. And so the potential future of the regulations was in doubt. And at that point, the people that I worked with and the department felt that it would be a good idea to try to negotiate with the industry to make some revisions in the regulations. And this took place. It was completed approximately the end of July of this past year, but due to a glitch, the rules themselves didn't get placed in front of the WQCC, the revisions to the rules that had been adopted last year.
Water quality control.
Right. Did not get in front of the commission until November 16th. The commission did listen. There was a substantial period of time listening to the evidence that was presented by us, by the department, by the industry, as joint petitioners this time, and they did pass those revised rules. So we now have a set of dairy rules that will go into effect where the industry has gotten behind them. And I think that this is a tremendous achievement, and it's one of the big victories for the Law Center in the past year.
We're talking to John Block with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. So let's talk for a moment about what is the actual problem that regulations like this are trying to solve.
Well, the problem is controlling the relationship between industrial production and pollution. It's a fundamental issue that goes back to the 1960s when there were clean water, clean air, and various solid waste regulations passed in this country. And at different points, due to pressure from the federal government, the states have adopted regulations that, in almost all cases, conform to the regulatory standards of the federal protective acts. In one of the areas where there's been exemptions, as there have been for the chemical industry in various ways, for the petroleum industry in various ways, so too agricultural production has gotten a pass in many instances due to the fact that they have a very strong presence in Congress. In the same way, the dairy industry, very powerful lobby, the dairy industry needs to be regulated just like any other industry. The myth of the mom-and-pop farm dies when you move from 200 or 300 head of cows to something on the order of 1,500, 2,000. I mean, no real family by itself would be able to take care of that kind of stock of animals, milk them twice a day, clean up, keep everything going. So you're talking about industrial production here, and it's the kind of thing that needs to be regulated.
And I think the thing, I mean, when you hear the dairy industry, you think of, the happy cow grazing in the field, and there's this sort of idea that the earth can absorb whatever waste is produced by the animals, and that the kind of cycle of nature is happening by itself. But when you have confined production on that scale, you have this huge amount of essentially cow excrement going, well, where does it go?
Well, it goes into lagoons. And historically, the lagoons have been lined in a number of different ways. In the earliest days, they were unlined pits. Then farmers began to line them with dried manure. Eventually, a big progress was made. They moved to compacted earth, in some cases very carefully compacted clays, such as are used in the petroleum industry, and can, in fact, provide adequate storage, but you have to have a scientifically engineered clay liner. It's almost as if you're building what is an unbaked ceramic surface to hold the liquid. But that was not the case, and a lot of the kinds of lagoons that we see in use here were unlined, and they were made out of compacted earth, and so they leak. And these lagoons are generally 1 to 2 acres in size, and depending upon the size of the operation, they will hold and they will get an input of anywhere from a little over 1,000 to 550,000 gallons a day of dairy waste products. The average is somewhere around 63,000 gallons a day. And there's very high nitrogen concentrations in this. The kinds that are used to hold the waste that's then used, mixed with water, and used for land application to grow silage crops of various kinds, which, by the way, can't be fed to the cows, and I'll explain that.
So when you say, I mean, it's basically fertilizer.
Yes, it's used as fertilizer for silage, but it's not silage. It'll be
alfalfa.
It will be the kinds of things you might feed to the cow, but here you can't do that. And there's a number of reasons why, but you can't use it for that purposes. It's used for other purposes, agricultural purposes. But the nitrogen content in that kind of material is about 281 milligrams per liter. And where it's used for just disposal by evaporative means, it's about 619 milligrams per liter. You're talking about orders of magnitude, a number of orders of magnitude above levels that you would want to be exposed to in drinking water. So this stuff is, for human beings and for other forms of animal life, fairly toxic waste.
If it's dried in ponds, are you then breathing it?
Well, that's one of the things that happens to people who live in these areas. As you might also imagine, the cycle of life being what it is, maggots, flies, worms of various kinds live in this waste. And so people who may live in the areas around these dairies are often exposed to literally swarms of huge flies. And many dairy owners don't want to put down the fly population because those flies are involved in the process of digesting that waste. There's also dust and dirt and debris that comes off of piles of manure or when the soil is dry after there's been water application, then it dries out. The dust carries these chemicals in it. And all of that is part of the overall picture of the pollution issues that confront the dairies. In this state, so far, all we've been able to regulate through the Water Quality Control Commission is the liquid portion of the waste. And the regulations that have been revised preserve the core, most important part of the regulations that had been originally passed last year. And briefly, what that is a model, an input-output model, so that the department can keep track, basically, through tracking the nitrogen, of whether there's anything going into the environment. They will have monitoring wells so they can assure themselves through the placement of the wells that if there is anything getting out, it'll be picked up in the well, and they'll see it and try to use some kind of abatement before it gets into human water supply or contaminates an aquifer. And this is an important aspect of, the regulatory process, that the regulators be able to keep a handle on it. From the point of view of my clients, one of the other things that was preserved was a notice provision that they had all wanted in the final rule that provides written notice mailed to everybody within a mile of one of the sites where somebody's applied for an application to build one of these mega dairies. And in the notice, there'll be a map that will show clearly where it's going to be and show it in relation to landmarks that people might be familiar with. So there is now a process in place that's been approved that the industry got behind after negotiations that will be out on the street, so to speak. The importance of this at this stage is because permitting has been held up, essentially, over this period of time. From the industry's point of view, they can't get money that they need to turn over a production cycle unless they've got permits, because the lenders won't loan them the money.
So you're talking about new dairies?
Existing dairies. If the dairies have to get their permit renewed. All of those things are held up in this process, and it means that the income for the department has been held up as well. And as of the end of December, they were about $415,000 in the hole. Since almost a year has gone by, I would imagine that it's quite a bit more than that. And it's that money that funds the department, including its enforcement division, for dealing with this particular issue. And so having permitting process in place now is quite important for both the industry, so they can get the money they need to finance their operations, but also for the regulator and for the public, because without there being any possibility of enforcement, no matter what regulations you have, you're really not getting anything. You can have beautiful regulations, but if you don't have money for enforcement, they really mean nothing. They're just purely academic.
So when this is all said and done and the wheels are turning, permitting fees will then be collected. Presumably the department will be out of the hole enough to pay enforcement people. But what is the enforcement like? Do we have government, New Mexico State employees going from dairy to dairy doing the kind of nitrogen testing that you were just talking about?
Well, it is. There is part of it, of course, that's self-regulating in the sense that the dairies are required to do certain testing, submit the results and show those results to the enforcement people. Enforcement people then will go out to the dairies to meet with them. This happens particularly when there's an issue and there's an abatement taking place. But we do have such people. Certainly the economic circumstances of the state have led to not filling positions that have been vacated and a lack of funding in the department. So there is no doubt a need for more enforcement people, for more funding for these kinds of activities, not just in the Water Bureau, but probably all of the state agencies that deal with the enforcement of regulations. And I think that when they have adequate funding, the right kind of enforcement can take place. I certainly have a question as to whether this is going to turn out to have been an academic exercise, not because we didn't get good rules passed through a negotiated process, but because even though we have the good rules, there won't be money put in the budget to do the enforcement.
So what's the next step for that? Does the legislature have anything to say about it?
Well, certainly that would be something that listeners who are concerned could take to the legislature. I would think that people who care about water quality in the state need to understand that the first part of this process is getting these regulations passed, but that the long-term constant commitment that is required to have them enforced and to really use them to raise higher and higher the standards that we apply, not just to water, but ultimately to air, to land, and to everything else connected with industrial agriculture, those things are not going to happen without continuous, conscious, active pressure on the part of an informed electorate. And they need to be letting their legislators know that, you know, they've got to find money somehow to fund these kinds of enforcement activities.
So here we have an issue where finally the citizens and the industry have come to a place of agreeing on these regulations. The regulations are there. With any luck, they'll be enforced. And so with some luck, we'll go forward in a state where we'll have safe drinking water around dairies. Is that your sense of it?
I think that that's a likely thing. However, you know, the kind of struggle that's necessary just doesn't stop there. People can go to our website, www.nmelc.org, and get a tremendous amount of information about all of the other issues that are going on right now that kind of follow on this administration's push to stop these regulations from going into effect. There's the Green Building Code case that's still going on. There's the struggle now about repeal of the greenhouse gas case. Copper regulations, which were required to be implemented at the same time in the same piece of legislation that required the dairy regulations, those are coming up too. And again, people need to be aware, to keep informed, and to keep the pressure up on legislative and administrative bodies to be sure that we in this state get higher and higher levels of protection of the air, the water, the land, and the communities that live in and about these industrial and quasi-industrial activities.
John Block is staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. They're on the web at nmelc.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. It was my pleasure.
And I'm very happy to welcome back to the show Jonathan Richards. He is an actor, writer, cartoonist, man of many talents, and his latest, shall I call it production?
We should say venture.
Venture is, he is one of four actors in John Brown's Body, which is at the Lensic this coming Sunday, the 11th of December, featuring not only Jonathan Richards, but Bob Martin, Ally McGraw, and Molly Sturges. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It is great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
Now, this is what you call a dramatic reading of the epic Civil War poem by Stephen Vincent Benet. Let's talk about Benet for a moment. Who was he? Very well known in his time.
Probably, arguably, the best-known American writer in his time, probably along with F. Scott Fitzgerald. But he was a, for this poem, which he wrote in Paris in 1928, and in 1929 it won the Pulitzer Prize, and he was really the toast of the literary world at that time. He came from a family, two siblings, a brother and a sister, both of whom became well known, not as, you know, as much of, you know, sort of rock stars as Stephen did, but his sister Laura became a successful poet, and his brother William Rose Benet compiled the Reader's Encyclopedia, which under his name, which I think is still in use. So they were all quite well known at the time, and for some time, I think John Brown's Body and Stephen Vincent Benet were taught in schools. I think one of the reasons that he's fallen away from the radar screen in latter years is because he's no longer on many of the school syllabi.
I was thinking of what it must be, what it must have been like to write a Civil War epic in 1928, because it was really within the memory, 1860s, of people who were still living.
Absolutely. When I was growing up in the, I remember in the early 50s, in Labor Day and 4th of July parades, they would still be trotting out the old Civil War veterans. I mean, they were pretty old, and they had been, drum boys or something like that, but they were still around. So in 1928, yes, there were still vigorously living men and women who had lived through that terrible thing, and I'm sure that he drew to some extent on actual first-person recollections.
Tell us about this. We're going to hear you read a little bit, but tell us about this epic. Who are the characters in it? What is the sweep of the drama?
The sweep of the drama, he begins with a little sketching in of the slave trade, and which provides the, you know, a lot of the emotional background for the Civil War itself. But he mostly takes us from the beginnings of the war, the firing on Fort Sumter, and he takes us through the sweep of the war. What we're going to be doing is a much abridged portion of the poem. The poem itself, I believe, goes through to the end of the war and the death of Lincoln. This does not take us that far.
And it takes, if you do the whole thing, which has been done, it takes, what, 2 or 3 hours or
well,
something
and
to
even
read?
There was a production done of this in the 50s, in the middle 50s, Charles Laughton adapted the poem for the stage, for a staged reading as we were doing it. And the Broadway cast that he presented was Tyrone Power, Judith Anderson, and Raymond Massey. And he had a big chorus of I think the voices of Walter Schumann or something like that. We are doing a smaller version than that, and that was a smaller version than the poem itself. It is described, I don't know how far you can justify this, but I've seen it described as the only American epic poem.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
What else comes to mind?
Well, I don't know. Carl Sandburg have anything that would be...
Walt Whitman?
Yeah, and possibly... I don't know. I mean, yeah, no.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean,
Walt Whitman
is perhaps maybe the only American, great American epic poem.
And certainly, if not the only, right up there in a small company.
Exactly.
Benet, interestingly, his father, as I remember it, was a military man. But he would read aloud poetry and other things. He would read aloud to the children as they were growing up, moving around at various military bases. And so Benet grew up with the tradition in his head of hearing poetry read aloud. And he intended this to be read aloud. It's the sound as well as the shape of the words that have importance for the way he composed it.
So the piece was written in 1928. It won the Pulitzer Prize. Then did it go on to have a lot of performances?
Well, it wasn't, it was written, he hoped that people would sit around reading it aloud, but it wasn't written as a stage piece. The performances didn't come until the 50s when Laughton did his adaptation. And then it played on Broadway with that cast and toured with that cast, but and has been done since by... a number of professional and semi-professional groups as well. But it's one of the classic things in American dramatic literature designed for a reading as opposed to a performance,
right.
As opposed to a staged performance.
And I have to say, and I know this is a personal preference and that not everybody feels that way, but I have a tremendous love of theater that is read rather than totally acted out, because in a way the pictures are more vivid in your head than anything that can be produced within the limits of a stage, particularly in an era where we're so used to the realism of film.
Right. Well, in a way that's the same the same ratio as you have between reading a book and seeing the movie. When you're reading the book, you have all of these pictures in your head and all of these characters in your head, and they are all shrunk down to a choice of one when you see them on film.
Yeah, that's true. So in the performance that you are doing now, we're talking to Jonathan Richards about the dramatic reading of the epic Civil War poem by Stephen Vincent Benet called John Brown's Body. Are you working with the adaptations that have gone before, or did you make your own?
Yeah, no, we're working from, but editing, just to try to streamline it a bit more for a slightly shorter evening. The piece combines historical characters and fictional characters. The fictional characters primarily are Jack Elliott, who is a northern boy from Connecticut, who joins the Union Army, and Clay Wingate of Wingate Hall, the southern plantation, who becomes an officer in the Confederacy. And there are two women who they become romantically attached with, Melora Villas, who is from nomadic. She and her father sort of move around dodging battles and scraping out a living. And then Sally Dupre is the southern belle who is not quite good enough for the Wingate family, as far as the Wingate family is concerned. And she basically has to wait for a bit of the come down of the South in order to establish her claim to Clay. But the historical figures, Abraham Lincoln and Robert E. Lee, John Brown, of course, and others come into it as well. So it goes back and forth between the history and these personal stories, these fictional stories that Binet tells.
And so what are some of the roles? I mean, in a dramatic reading with four people, presumably everybody plays a bunch of different roles.
Everybody plays a bunch of different roles. Primarily I do Jack Elliott and Clay Wingate. Ali primarily does Melora Villis and Sally Dupre. But we all do, and Bob does Lincoln and John Brown. He does more of the historical characters. But we all spill over, you know, and do much more than just individual characters.
And it's great to see Bob Martin, executive director of the Lensic,
yes, it
up
is.
On the stage. He's a terrific actor. I
Very
had no
good
idea
actor.
Until... When was it, a few years ago, that they did the Laramie Project 10 years later, and there he was, and he was just excellent.
Bob is very, he's just a very solid guy and very talented. He's a still water, but runs very deep.
Yeah, and then Molly Sturges, wonderful performer.
Molly is a wonderful performer, and she will be adding primarily music and singing to our production. We don't have the resources or the time to pull together a full chorus as was done in the original. So Molly basically will take on the responsibilities of the chorus and everything else.
Amazing. And then, of course, the wonderful and world-famous Ally McGraw.
Ally is just terrific in this. The first time we read it through, she read it cold and just nailed it. Yeah, so I'm really pleased to be able to induce her onto a stage. She picks her spots sparingly, and this is a great adventure and a great source of enthusiasm for us to have Ally on board.
Doing this production, did it give you any insights into American history or the Civil War?
I think one thing it gives you insight into the Civil War is it kind of puts you into, one of the pieces I'll read is a little lead into the Battle of Gettysburg, and by this time Jack Elliott and Clay Wingate and all the troops of North and South have really been through it, and and I think one thing Binet does very well is to just create with the little, sketching with his pencil what these soldiers looked like, what they felt like, what they smelt like, what they, what they endured.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the reasons we wanted to do this, the idea of doing it in this year, is this is the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War. Not this date. It began, back in the spring. But we thought that this is something that we all need to constantly remind ourselves of what can happen, especially when... At times like the present, when we find ourselves somewhat sundered by wildly opposing ways of philosophies of life, where you have the 99% and the 1%, and you have Occupies, and you have the Tea Party, and you have so many things that, you have a one major political party whose entire agenda is to defeat the president, the sitting president, rather than accomplishing legislation.
Or to consolidate its own power.
Consolidate its own power and not worry about employment or whatever else, as long as, as Mitch McConnell has said, our number one aim and agenda is to defeat the president. So when, I'm not saying that particularly in a partisan sense. Of course, I am, but more just to point out the fact that we are at a divide which is certainly not as severe as it was in 1860, but it can give us a kind of an insight into how that can happen.
My personal view about that is that we were fighting the Civil War in the 18th century, we were fighting it in the 19th century, we're fighting it in the 20th century, and we're still fighting the Civil War in the United States of America.
We are still fighting it, but at least, thank God, we are not going out and shooting at people we went to college with. You have all of these generals who were probably classmates at West Point, Lee and Grant and Sheridan, and all these people who suddenly came to a point where their loyalties were pulled apart, and they became, and you know, not just them, but of course, there were even families in which, you know, we have a lot of Civil War folk songs about two brothers who, you know, one wore blue and one wore gray. So that's the thing that I think we need to keep alive in our minds, is what it can come to if we don't watch out.
But I guess I was referring more to the racial issues, which we still have.
Absolutely.
Viciously and intensely in the hearts of some segment of people in this nation. It's very disturbing.
And it's important to remember, and it comes out a bit in the text of this rumination of Abraham Lincoln, that Lincoln was not unalterably committed to the freeing of the slaves. He was unalterably committed to the preserving of the Union, and beyond that he would do, you know, when we look at the things that we hold against Obama for not accomplishing, you have to consider that when you're in that job, as Lincoln was, there are things that are of paramount importance, and then other things that you want to get done, and you do what you can. There is a passage where Lincoln has drafted the Emancipation Proclamation and is ready to release it, but he has nothing but defeat on the battlefield, and Seward recommends to him that he wait until he has some good news, and when he has some good news, when they win a battle, when things begin to turn ever so slightly in the Union favor, that would be the time, so that it doesn't seem like a desperate cry, but an actual coming from a position of strength.
Jonathan Richards, would you like to read maybe just a little bit of John Brown's Body?
Well, I thought I'd read, because it's interesting that Benet wrote this, his great American epic of the Civil War, while he was living in Paris. He chose or used that perspective of that distance. And the very beginning of the poem sort of makes reference to that he is that he's writing this from a distance. And it begins, "This flesh was seeded from no foreign grain, but Pennsylvania and Kentucky wheat. And it is soaked in California rain and 5 years tempered in New England sleet to strive at last against an alien proof, and by the changes of an alien moon to build again that blue American roof over a half-forgotten battle tune and call unsurely from haunted ground armies of shadows at the shadow sound." So he's saying, I may be over here in Paris, but I'm not a foreigner. I've been tempered in New England sleet, and I've got all this. And then the other, I'll read in one other short piece about that same length. And this is as the, getting ready for the Battle of Gettysburg, which is, you know, which was one of the truly terrible battles of the Civil War, and came deep enough into it that the troops pretty much knew what was at stake. "The firing began that morning at 9 o'clock, but it was 3 before the attacks were launched. They say the bluecoats, marching through the ripe wheat, made a blue and yellow picture that men remembered even in their age, in their crack-voiced age. They say the noise was incessant as the sound of all wolves howling when that attack came on. The men who fought then were the tired fighters, the hammered, the weather-beaten, the very hard-dying men. They came and died. They came again and died. They stood there and died. But at last, when the round sun dropped and that last attack came with its cry, Jack Elliott saw it come on."
Jonathan Richards is one of the performers in John Brown's Body at the Lensic on Sunday, December 11th at 7 in the evening. For more information, you can go to lensic.org. You can call for tickets 988-1234. The other performers are Bob Martin, Ally McGraw, and Molly Sturges. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was my great pleasure, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like right now to welcome to the program Carl Colby. His documentary film, The Man Nobody Knew, In Search of My Father, CIA Spymaster William Colby, opens this week at the Screen here in Santa Fe, and Carl will be at the screening this Wednesday, December 7th at 7 o'clock, doing an introduction and a Q&A. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this film traces the life of your father, William Colby, who eventually became director of the CIA. Why did you decide to make this film? What happened?
Well, I'd always been making profiles of various people throughout my life, and including film on Bob Marley, film on Frank Gehry, a film on Willem de Kooning, film on Franz Kline, a film on George Harrell, and then an Emmy Award winner, a film on Franco Zeffirelli, the Italian film and opera director. So you would have thought that, well, why didn't I do a profile of my father earlier on? But he was the sort of person that if he was alive today, he would talk very intelligently and astutely about, let's say, what's going on in Syria and what's going on in Cairo. But if you started asking him a very personal question about, well, what was his relationship with my mother and how could he describe that, he'd sort of just glaze over. So I never really pursued doing anything about him because I thought it would be frustrating from a personal, revelatory sort of point of view. And then I was watching CNN's coverage of the fall of the Twin Towers on 9/11, and Wolf Blitzer came on and asked James Baker, who'd been Secretary of State, how this happened. And Baker said, I traced this back directly to when William Colby testified before the Senate and House intelligence committees in the 70s and revealed the CIA's family jewels, which decimated America's ability to conduct covert action and clandestine activities around the world, leading to disasters just like this. I was sort of really taken aback. I thought, well, my father's been dead 5 years, and now he's relevant again. And then 2 weeks later, I see photographs of CIA operatives sporting beards and wearing turbans and riding camels and horses across the Afghanistan northern territories riding with the Northern Alliance against the Taliban. And I thought, well, that looks like OSS. So I started working on the film around that time.
Explain to us what this term means, the crown jewels.
Well, it's the family jewels or the crown jewels. And what that meant is a lot of the secrets of the CIA, some of the things, particularly the wrongdoing that they'd done from really its inception from the end of the 1940s all the way through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, finally kind of just arrived on the desk of my father when he first became CIA director. They were sort of trying to clear house in a way, you know, and account for everything. And it came at a really bad time because the country was already convulsed with Nixon about to resign and disgrace. And so there was a lot of suspicion in the country. And so the House and Senate committees, senators like Senator Church and Otis Pike, the congressman from New York, and Bella Abzug, they really took it upon themselves to kind of take apart the CIA and, you know, what were we doing and why. And so my father really had to sort of defend the agency. And he did that by revealing a lot of the secrets when the White House wanted him to completely stonewall and not say a thing.
Watching the film, I was thinking, the crown jewels, as they're called, and it's kind of a weird euphemism. I mean, we're talking about highly illegal activities that have nothing to do with gathering intelligence. We're talking about assassination plots, and we're talking about other kinds of torture and secret prisons and things like that that we regular old taxpaying Americans, probably most of us, really don't want happening. And so on the one hand, yeah, it hurt the CIA. On the other hand, these things should not be happening.
Well, these things happen because the president wants them to happen. The misnomer is to think of the CIA as just some rogue operation that does what it wants and is accountable to no one. The truth of the matter and why it's important to see the film is that you see that from the earliest days onward, the presidents order these actions. There's something called a finding, and it goes on today, that when you want to mount a covert operation of any kind, you have the president's physical signature on it. He signs off, and then the helicopters take off and go on the mission. And just to clarify, I mean, this president, Obama, got his hands full with the economy and all, but he's ordering up as much, if not more, covert action than any president since the Kennedys. It's very seductive. It's like a private force. You don't really have to account much to Congress. You have to inform a few committees, and you can deny that you ever did it in the first place. So it's a very tough, tough kind of situation, and you might say, well, let's just not do any of this. Well, all right, you tell me what we shouldn't do. Should we just gather intelligence like a newspaper operation and just let the world go as it goes? I don't know.
What?
My dad used
What's
to say
wrong with
the CIA
that?
Exists so that there's a So the president has a choice between lodging a diplomatic protest and sending in the U.S. Marines.
Again, watching the film, it was so interesting because, okay, you look at Vietnam. Your father went to Vietnam in 1959, and, I mean, clearly a very dedicated public servant is the way he saw himself, and very competent. I mean, most people, I would venture to say, at this point, see Vietnam as a bad idea that turned into a bloody and hopeless morass. He had a very different, what was his perspective on why he was there at the beginning and as his time there evolved?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what he felt was that the opposition was Ho Chi Minh, who was communist and authoritarian and wanted to dominate the country, the entire country. And so the Americans sort of propped up this President Diem and his brother to sort of run the show down there and give us kind of a holding action. I mean, in the bigger picture, I think we were very afraid of the Chinese and very afraid of the Russians, but particularly the Chinese. What we didn't really understand was at the time is that the Vietnamese and the Chinese have hated each other for more than 1,000 years. There's no way that they would link up together. But that was sort of a threat that we thought, you know, domino theory, that the whole of Southeast Asia would fall.
The example that you just gave is something that we could probably find a half a dozen examples of, where you have these horrible wars that are fought and this basic reality, which should be what the CIA is all about, namely failing to recognize that the Vietnamese and the Chinese don't like each other. I mean, isn't that what intelligence forces are supposed to figure out in the first place?
I would also say, though, who's making the decision to launch the war? The CIA is probably telling, actually, and the State Department was telling the president and the Pentagon in the early 60s and late 50s that the Chinese and the Vietnamese hated each other. But who's listening? Why did the president, why did he override those opinions? It's like now, the National Security Council and President Obama sits in a room and listens to 7 or 8 analysts tell him what's likely to happen in Egypt. Then he has to make a decision. And often the people in the room, hopefully, they've got different opinions, not just a yes man, not just telling him what he wants to hear. And then he's got to make that choice. So, and he does make a choice. And in the case of Vietnam, obviously, Johnson and particularly Johnson, made very bad choices. But it's the president, and if you don't like it, then you ought to let your president know about it.
We're talking to Carl Kolbe about his film, The Man Nobody Knew. Your mother is, I mean, as much as the film is a portrait of your father, it's kind of a portrait of your mother, too. She appears a lot in the film, and she's a loyal and beautiful and clearly very good woman who, it turns out, really, like you, didn't know her husband, your father. The film is called The Man Nobody Knew. What was it like for her and for you to talk about your father? And now it's, what, a good 15 or 20 years after his death?
Yeah, my mother was referred to by James Angleton, who is the famous chief of counterintelligence, legendary in the CIA, referred to my mother as the most loyal CIA wife ever. And I think my mother regarded my father as being on a mission, on a mission to bring good into the world, to bring clarity, but also to be forthright and to be moral and to be right. And it had to be right and it had to be good, or it wouldn't pass muster with her. So you don't really think that you're going to see anything about my mother when you walk into the theater. But then you understand that my mother is the underpinning of it all. She even called the CIA euphemistically CIA, Catholics in Action. In other words, like priests, like missionaries, zealots, who went out to make the world a safer place. And it's a fascinating sort of parallel, because then you have somebody who is taking it on faith and trust that what her husband is doing is the right thing. And that's kind of the whole movie in a nutshell. It's a morality tale. And who are you supporting and why? And do you believe in this man? And do you believe in this cause? And then what do you know and what you don't know? And much of what you know, you really don't know, or it's a lie. It's very difficult to support somebody in that mission. So that's kind of the whole kernel of the movie, is this kind of balancing act between is what's being done lawful, but then also is what's being done right, and is it good, and is it something that Americans do? And those questions are something that I think resonate with audiences today, and I can certainly hear it in your voice that that's what you're most concerned with, is not just the history, but who are we now?
Carl Colby is a filmmaker. His new documentary is called The Man Nobody Knew, In Search of My Father, CIA Spymaster William Colby. Once again, it opens this week at the Screen here in Santa Fe, and Carl will be at the screening on Wednesday at 7 o'clock doing the introduction and Q&A. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay, thanks so much.